Welcome to the High Velocity Radio Show. High Velocity Radio is brought to you by PSI Digital Media Experts, the market leader in delivering digital media services. From manufacturing millions of CDs and DVDs to turnkey e-commerce solutions and streaming high-definition video over their worldwide content distribution network, PSI has the solutions to meet your needs. Find PSI at psidiscs.com, psidiscs.com. The High Velocity Radio Show is where we celebrate innovative professionals producing better results in less time. Produced and directed by Lee Cantor and brought to you live from Radio X Studio in Atlanta, Georgia. Now here are your hosts, Todd Schnick and Stone Payton.
Welcome to the High Velocity Radio Show. This is your host, Stone Payton, and in the studio with me this morning is our producer, Lee Cantor, and my good buddy and co-host, Todd Schnick. Good morning, Todd.
Morning, Stone. How are you this morning?
I am doing well. Coming off of spring break with the kids down in Pensacola, Florida. Got a little color.
Wow. You look good with color. I've never seen you with color.
Yeah.
Ever.
Well, if I stay out there a little longer, all the freckles will come together.
Very nice. So how's the fish fry?
Oh, it was marvelous. It was great. And we went out to the beach and watched the guys catch sharks off the pier. And I think we might have had a margarita or two. And a little shout out to McGuire's. We all went to McGuire's.
Oh, which, I've been to McGuire's.
Yeah, that's we kissed the moose and did the whole bit.
Oh, yeah.
How about you? What'd you do while I was gone?
Oh, gosh. Had a busy weekend. Softball on Friday night. Brutal tennis match on Saturday. Ran 6 miles as part of my training yesterday. So this old body is sore today.
You're not going to let go of this athletic dream, are you? What is it with people your age that are still playing ball and running and all that stuff?
Have you seen the fact that my shirt's untucked? It's because I'm fat, so I'm trying to get in better shape.
We special ordered the High Velocity Radio shirts so that they were designed not to be tucked in. That was a conscious decision, wasn't
it? Yes. Well, we need the excess material on the bottom part of it.
Well, I'm glad to be back, though. We have a marvelous show for everybody this morning. In a little while, we're going to hear from a lady named Linda Frakes. But first up, on the High Velocity Radio Show, is a gentleman by the name of Dave Sutton. He's with Top Right. He's written more than one book, and he's got a new book coming out. Looking forward to hearing all about that. Welcome to the show, Dave.
Thanks, guys. Good to see you.
Well, we are delighted to have you on the show. Tell us a little bit about Top Right and what you guys are out there doing for folks.
Well, we're a strategic marketing consulting business. We're located here in Atlanta. We tend to focus on clients that are kind of out-of-the-box thinkers, revolutionary kinds of thinkers as it relates to their marketing and the approach that they take to sales and marketing their products and services.
So I mentioned that you'd already written one book, and it's been quite successful. Tell us a little bit about that first one. What was it about?
We wrote a book called Enterprise Marketing Management, co-authored it with a guy named Tom Klein here in town. And that book was really focused on trying to identify ways that we could enable greater success in marketing function across different types of businesses, trying to use technology differently. These were the days before social media, so we were trying to give people tips and tricks and hints on how best to get the most out of their marketing capabilities.
What kind of things were you doing back before social media that was utilizing technology?
Oh, you know, good old-fashioned stuff like email campaigns, promotions, essentially leveraging technology as a delivery vehicle as opposed to, you know, just using it to automate the back office.
You did things like with CRM too, right?
Yeah, we did a lot of work with customer relationship management, CRM, digital essentially outreach programs, whether it was through the internet, e-commerce types of applications, also email, a lot of email campaign work.
Is email and CRM still important today?
I think it's even more important. I think that the challenge has become that, you know, the bar has been raised. I mean, now everybody's got it. But we used to joke about how CRM, really basically the initial should stand for can't replace marketing.
I like that.
Unfortunately, what's happened with CRM is a lot of people just, you know, plugged it in, figure they've got a great customer database and they'd be able to get a lot of value out of it. But the reality is you can have all the information you want about your customers, but if you forget about marketing and positioning your brands, you're kind of dead in the water.
Can't you do well if you use Excel, if you do all the work, the follow-up? I mean, I know all these clients and customers out there that have the latest, coolest, hippest CRM software, but they don't do anything with it, so it's useless. I think you could use index cards if you did the follow-up work that was critical.
Why is he looking at me when he's saying that?
Because you use the post-it note strategy.
Hidden agenda and all that?
That's your post-it note strategy that I find fascinating. But
Todd, it's a great point, and it's something we see all the time. And people go out and they think, I can just buy a box of technology, buy a box of software, and it's going to solve all my problems. And in the first book, what we did was we laid out essentially a disciplined approach to how you get value out of these tools. So to your point, if you don't have a process for using customer information and exercising it and making it actionable in your business, all you end up with is a very expensive piece of software that is good at, you know, kind of electronically organizing stuff like your index cards. And without that organization that knows how to use it and the skills and the capabilities to essentially execute against your marketing strategy, you just don't get any value out of it.
Well, you're not as long as in the tooth as some of the folks sitting around this table, but this isn't your first rodeo. As you go back and look at that early work, were people as antsy and skeptical about CRM and email and those kinds of things back then as some of them seem to be now about social media tools? Was it that? Did you see the same thing?
There's been a long history of kind of the difference between marketing and technology. We used to talk about kind of oil and water. You know, they just don't mix. And one of the challenges, I think, is marketing has been really kind of forced to get outside the box as it relates to how to use social media, how to use electronic vehicles for reaching their customers. Because the reality is most of us buy stuff. And there are multiple touch points before we actually make a decision to buy something. And if you're not taking advantage of all your channels that you have available to you, you're kind of, you know, talking to just one part of the overall buying cycle with a customer. Things have I think they've accelerated, but there's still that oil and water friction, if you will, between marketing and technology in many companies today.
Well, let's talk about this new book. You talk about trying to serve revolutionary marketers. Say more about that, if you will.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. I mean, people always ask us about the kinds of companies we serve, the kinds of brands that we work with. And, we did kind of a look inside of our own targeting and segmentation. What we found was they're not big companies. They're not small companies. They're not companies with big budgets. They're not companies with small budgets. What they are is they're companies that have great leaders that really believe that marketing is going to take them to the next level. So they really view marketing as a key driver of organic growth. And in many cases, these are companies that they've essentially evolved their business, or they've made a substantial shift in the performance of their business by thinking about marketing differently. So we decided to write a book about those stories and really trying to bring to light some of the not so obvious examples of great marketing. I mean, everybody's heard the story about, you know, Apple and the iPod and now the iPhone and now the iPad. And there's been tons written about people like Steve Jobs, the Coca-Colas of the world. So we're trying to reveal the lesser known stories and the people that maybe didn't have a big budget. You know, they wanted to have a Fortune 500 impact with their marketing, but they had an Inc. 500 budget. And how did they essentially create something out of nothing? And we think those are really compelling stories and lessons that can be learned and shared regardless of the type of business that you have.
Are the people you're featuring, are they local or are they national or international?
Well, our ambition right now, we're on kind of the last leg of our research program right now, and we've found great stories globally. We've got companies that we're working with that are kind of far afield, and we got people right here in our backyard. So, it just goes to show that great marketing can be anywhere, anytime.
Well, I'm operating under the impression that there must be some consistency, some patterns that you see across the board. Can you share some of those that will excite us but won't keep us from buying your book?
Yeah, I don't want to give away the secret
right,
sauce. Right?
Exactly.
Right. No, it's a great question, Stone. And there's actually a handful of things that are we call them markers of true marketing excellence. Think about it, if you were kind of mapping out the human genome. If you're mapping out the marketing genome, what are the common markers of really excellent performance? And some of it begins with some of the things we talked about just a minute ago. You know, do you really deeply understand your customer? And what we mean by that is, do you really have not just an understanding of kind of where they are today, but where their needs are going to evolve over the next, you know, month, 2 months, 5 months, 10 months? We've got a great example in the book of a company, actually a local company here, that has done a fabulous job of essentially understanding their consumers so well that they can actually predict the next thing they're most likely to buy.
Wow.
And that's really a fantastic way to think about marketing. It's not just a reactive, I mean, someone raised their hand and said, I want this product. But can you begin, based on their past performance or their past purchase history, to predict the next handful of products that they may want or need? And that's a simple example, but it all begins with really deeply understanding the customer. There's a number of other markers. I won't go into all of them here today, but just getting under the covers in terms of what is important to your customer is kind of step one, and then really being able to map out all the different ways that they buy from you. So not just viewing marketing as making the product look attractive on the shelf, but what are all the other touch points that you have? What's the buying cycle that someone goes through? And then being able to make sure your brand is delivering against its promise at every one of those touch points, not just kind of on TV or on the radio, but really activating that brand at every possible opportunity that you have.
And cool golf shirts with a nice logo. Is that one of the markers that you guys
uncovered? Yeah, trinkets and trash. We call it trinkets and trash.
See how well we're doing, Todd?
We are on top of our game. There's only about 1 billion books published a year, and a lot of books that feature and spotlight all-stars. How is your book different from the books that do follow a similar concept?
Well, I think what we've set out to do with this book is, like I said, try to tell the stories that really never get told. So there's a lot of companies in this book that you would have never heard of, a lot of leaders from a marketing perspective that you may not have run across. And that goes from just not only local, like here in Atlanta and in the state of Georgia, but internationally, globally, companies that we think really don't get the airtime, maybe because they just, it's not that important to them. That said, there's a lot of
lessons. They're busy doing their work.
They're busy doing their work. They're not out there trying to get the spotlight on themselves.
Now, I'm fascinated by Apple, but I'm sick and damn tired of hearing about it.
You want to hear about somebody else, don't you?
Yeah.
They're great. They're great lessons to learn. And we actually, in the beginning of the book, the setup of the book, it talks about the fact that there are a lot of marketers who kind of are lazy, lucky, or fortunate, right? I mean, if you're sitting on top of a brand that has 100 years of equity, and not to name any names here locally, but it's a heck of a lot easier to be a shining star when you've got 100 years of equity behind you, you've got a tremendous budget backing you up, and you've got the ear of every analyst from coast to coast. And I'm not saying that's a bad thing. I'm just saying it's different. And it's sometimes easier. You don't have to work as hard, when you're living on top of that legacy. I like to tell the stories about the guys that don't have, maybe that's a completely new to the world brand or new product. Stories about people who have basically taken nothing and made something. Taken, where there was no demand and created demand out of thin air. I think those are compelling stories and also things that we can all learn from.
And I think we all agree that social media makes those stories much, much easier to tell. You don't have to be that 100-year legacy company anymore to be famous.
Absolutely, Todd. I mean, the great news, it's kind of a double-edged sword, though, isn't it? I mean, you can instantly be famous for the wrong things as well.
Or infamous.
Or infamous, yeah. So you have to be careful about how, I mean, unlike, the production environment of the past in terms of what it took to get your message on the airwaves, now it's, if it's out there, it's out there instantly and forever.
What I find intriguing and compelling and make somebody like me want to buy a book like this is it's not you and your buddy climbing up to the top of some mountain, smoking some peyote and coming down and telling us the secrets to marketing. You're out there. You're talking to people that are in the trenches. They're doing it. You're learning how they did it. You're looking for those patterns. I'm interested in the research process. How did you go about getting access to these folks, and how did you make some decisions about what you were going to ask them and what you were going to hold on to and then turn around and report to the rest of us?
It's interesting. Great question, because we struggle with that, because it is very easy to get caught up when you're doing research on the usual suspects, as I call it, the big names, the big brands, the stories that have been told many, many times. What we decided to do is actually take a spoonful of our own medicine and use our own social media and our own social networks to kind of take advantage and leverage the 6 degrees of separation. So we're active users of LinkedIn and Twitter and a lot of our tools for our own marketing. And what we found was, we know a lot of great people, kind of first order connections, local marketing companies, our own clients, and that's a great place to start. But what we wanted to do was go to the next level and find out who are their favorite examples, who are their favorite marketers, what stories have they heard, and then kind of cascading through that process. So our research has kind of followed the LinkedIn paradigm, if you will, of, can we get to third, fourth, fifth order connections, stories that you wouldn't necessarily hear, just day to day, but by leveraging your network, you can get access to.
Now, your first book was published by Wiley, and this the new one will be as well, correct?
Yes, correct.
So that's impressive, having a big box publisher like that. But what are some other things you'll have to do to help market that book?
Well, we love working with the traditional publishers, but again, I'll be the first one to tell you that they're not quite as up to speed on marketing themselves, and I think they'd even be the first to admit that. They're great from a broad distribution perspective, so if you want to get your book in Amazon, you want to get your book at Borders, they're great for that. But the reality is most people today are more apt to kind of find out about a book through personal referrals. You know, think about how many times you've read a book because somebody said, hey, Todd, you should go read this book, or through things that you kind of connect with online. So we're going to be using our blog, which is cornerthemarket.net, to actively kind of share some of our concepts as we go. So you might, if you go out there today, you'll see a lot of the things we've been writing about are actually themes that will be recurring in the book. So we're kind of pre-selling it, if you will. The other thing we're doing is obviously through our own networking, using Twitter, using Facebook, using LinkedIn, we're actively going to promote the book ourselves. And I think, the combination of doing speaking engagements, getting the word out on social media is a great way to essentially create primary demand for a book and not necessarily rely on someone just, passing by it at a Borders Books or in an airport someplace. I mean, I don't think people buy books in the traditional way anymore. That's kind of the dying way to buy a book.
It's really changing, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, when you look at, I guess it was, there was some data published recently about the number of books that were sold over Christmas on the Kindle, with Amazon versus traditional books. I mean, there are more books sold for the Kindle than there were traditional books over Christmas this year. And I think that's just, that's just the state of the future for us. I mean, if you don't have an electronic version ready for the iPad or the Kindle, you're kind of, stuck in late, 1990s technology, right? You're not keeping up with the Joneses. So.
Guilty.
Yeah, don't get me started.
Did anything surprise you in doing this research, just really take you back and say, wow, never really expected that?
The level of penetration of social media has surprised me because for me, and maybe I am a little bit long in the tooth like you guys, but it seems like that just happened, like yesterday. And then you look at, some of the smaller companies that we work with and how effectively they've kind of, they don't even think about TV. And sadly, guys, they don't think about radio that much either anymore. Right. They don't think about traditional broadcast. Everything begins with the social media strategy. And I think that's a big surprise, at least it was for me, that it's taken over that much of the marketing mind share, if you will, in such a short period of time. And I lived through the dot-com boom and bust as well. And back then I thought that, e-commerce was sort of this, machine that was going to eat everything. And of course it turned out that it didn't. It kind of was an augmentation, if you will, of the way that people sell their products and services. But this time around, it's really been shocking how quickly it's really changed the way people think about marketing.
But yet, 70% of small business people aren't active on social media. And Fortune 500, there's still a lot of those kind of companies that aren't engaged. Let me rephrase that. There are a lot of people that are active on it, but they're not doing it right.
Yeah.
They're still applying that traditional media one-way broadcast on those tools, and I think they're finding that that's not as effective.
Yeah, Todd, there's a huge amount of what I would call experimentation going on right now. I mean, everybody is doing something. I don't know how productive necessarily it is. I think there's some terrific stories of success in our book about folks that created a business basically just with social media. I mean, they just kind of eschewed going out and using any kind of traditional media. They've just gone directly to that, and they've created their whole business around that model. And then there are I'll call them the dinosaurs. I mean, people that are trying to get there, right? And they've really embraced it, and they may talk the talk and walk the walk. But at the end of the day, you look at what they're doing, and you kind of scratch your head and go, is it that exciting that, Dell's been able to sell 1 million PCs through social media? Well, yes, it's exciting, but if you look at it, it's really no different than what they've done with e-commerce and other ways that they go to market. They're just kind of reskinning it, right, and trying to sell the same thing through a different channel.
Oh, there are some that are doing it right. We had Bert DeMars on this show not too long ago, who's the VP of Interactive Marketing for Newell, Newell Rubbermaid, and he's a case study about what he and his team are doing one of their side items is the Graco.
Yes,
the baby products, and there was an unfortunate recall situation, and it could have been devastating to that brand and that product. But You should go listen to that broadcast because we had Bert kind of walk through step by step how they handled dealing with that recall situation through social media and how it actually turned around to be a plus for them. So yeah. There are a few people that are doing it right. I mean, I'm talking about big companies that are doing it right.
Absolutely. And you know, I think in crisis management, if you think about it, it's social media is made for dealing with crises. And it's powerful because if you can get a large enough block of people that are advocating for your point of view, one way or the other, it's hugely impactful because you don't have to worry about credentials. I mean, if you know, there's a huge body of people that are basically saying, hey, this car seat is safer than you think, and it's not coming directly from the company, or it's not perceived to be coming from the company.
Oh, that's a great point.
It's huge.
Well, and I like Sharpie Susan, which is also a new Rubbermaid brand, and I think she's out of Tennessee or something, but I like following her thing.
Oh yeah, no, that whole, and that's what
they have one for every brand, right? Don't they have
pretty much? Yeah, they do. But Bert's the one that's kind of ringleading all of that, and it's impressive right. What they're doing. So it's fun to watch that.
You know, a lot of our listeners, Dave, are aspiring authors, and so you've written a couple of books now, or you're about to release your second book. I wonder if you might have any sage advice to share with our aspiring authors. I don't know, lessons learned, things to do, things not to do, things to remember.
Well, I'll tell you, lesson number one we learned the hard way on the first book, which is you don't make any money writing books. You know, you really have to think about end-to-end what's your activation strategy. I mean, I joke with people that our first book was a thick brochure. You know, and it's a great way to get credential.
It's a $25 business card.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, it's a great way to get credentials. It's a great way to have a platform, you know, to talk about your business or, you know, your beliefs or whatever. But it fundamentally, if you look at it as an economic driver for your business, it's not gonna do much. You really have to look at it. It's almost like sponsoring the Braves. You know, you have to back it up with hospitality and different ways of essentially converting or monetizing that investment such that you're actually going to, you know, feed your core business. And for us, I mean, as a consulting firm, it becomes a platform for talking about the things that we think that marketers should care about. And so every book should really have that. And when you're writing a book, you should be thinking about how is that going to convert to opportunities for me to sell more of my products and services.
Well, the book is entitled In Search of Marketing Excellence, Lessons from the World's Most Revolutionary Marketers. When is this baby coming out, and how can we get our hands on it?
We're hoping, again, working with the publisher is always kind of challenging. We're hoping it's going to be out by the end of the year. It's pretty much done. We're doing, like I said, we're kind of finishing up on research at this point.
What's the best way for our listeners to keep tabs on that and get in touch with you and learn more about you and your work?
Well, learning about TopRight's easy. Just go to toprightpartners.com. And also, if you're interested in concepts related to the book, some of the things we talked about today, check out our blog, which is cornerthemarket.net. And that's where we use that platform to share a lot of these ideas.
What a great name for a blog, huh?
It sure is.
Well, listen, before we let you go, Dave, we have a little tradition here on the High Velocity Radio Show. We like to ask each guest if they would to share a mistake that they've made at some point in their career, and really, more importantly, what they feel like they learned from it. Could we get you to do that for us?
Yeah, I gave a lot of thought to it because I kind of knew ahead of time you were going to ask me that question.
Right.
But, you know, I was thinking back over my career and something a move that I made actually probably about 5 or 6 years ago now, I'd always had in the back of my mind that I really wanted to be the CEO of a company, and specifically a publicly traded company. And, you know, I learned the lesson the hard way that, you know, be careful what you wish for. And also, you know, the other, because that happened, I actually got what I wanted kind of in the midst of Sarbanes-Oxley and kind of, you know, what it takes to be a CEO today is more of an administrative and pencil-pushing kind of job than I ever thought it would be. You know, stay true to yourself is kind of the lesson that I learned through that experience. I mean, you may want something, but it may not necessarily stay true to what you're good at and what you enjoy doing on a day-to-day basis. So I love marketing, and I love working with people who are out-of-the-box thinkers when it comes to marketing. And unfortunately, accountants and finance people aren't. And as a CEO of a publicly traded company, you spend a lot of time with your CFO, and it's hard to kind of be true to what you really are good at and what you enjoy doing.
What great advice. Stay in your wheelhouse.
Exactly. Stay in your wheelhouse.
Well, it has been an absolute delight having you, and I hope you'll come back and visit with us again sometime.
Absolutely. Thanks, Stone. Thanks, Todd. Appreciate
you. You are more than welcome. Can you hang out with us for a little while we introduce our next guest and visit with her?
Be happy to.
All right. Well, Todd, who else we have with us this morning?
The next guest on the High Velocity Radio Show is an author, teacher, trainer, I think, as well, a former six-figure executive who had to file bankruptcy, and the author of a book called How to Go Broke with Style. Welcome to the show, Linda Frakes.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
He's flabbergasted.
We've never made an introduction like that before. tell us your story. Tell us how you got to having to write this book.
We are going to go from the serious to the snarky now. I was in corporate America for years and years, left when I had my son 15 years ago because I decided that I needed to balance my life a little bit, and became an entrepreneur, and had a very successful run, decided that it was time to sell, probably a little bit too late, several years back, and I'll lead with one of my mistakes. I thought now is the time to sell after the peak had come and gone. So I made the mistake of selling too late, had to make some compromises, and one of those was holding a note, a pretty good-sized note, on a business that I sold. And within a year, that person was defaulting on the note, and there went my income. So I went from being very comfortable very quickly landsliding into being very broke.
Well, there's countless stories that we hear about every day about people who have a similar story or lost their job or what have you in this economy. There just seems to be this natural fear of bankruptcy. That's just this evil thing that ruins your life forever. It's not, but that's not really the case, is it not?
It's really not, and I wish I would have known that before I went through the process. I guess my perception was that I was going to have this scarlet letter B that I was going to have to wear on all my clothing, and everybody would know that I was a bankrupt and a terrible, unsuccessful example of an entrepreneur. And, you know, the books that you're talking about that have been out there, I wish I would have seen those. The reason I wrote the book primarily was because when I was entering into the process, I went to the bookstore, looked around to see if there was any kind of helicopter view books about the process and what it meant to the rest of your life and your financial well-being. And there was nothing there. There were a lot of very specific niche books written by attorneys, which I'm not, and you know, very dry books about the process of going broke and, you know, how to file Chapter 7 in $400,000 or less and all those kinds of things, but really no overview of the process and kind of helping people understand that you don't wear the scarlet letter, they don't come to your house and take your dog, that it's not as bad as you might think it would be. It's not a desirable outcome, but at some point it might be the only solution.
Well, the subtitle of your book is A User's Guide to Filing or Avoiding Bankruptcy with Humor and Grit.
Amen.
Amen. Okay, so perhaps what you could do for us and our listeners is explain a couple of scenarios where people get into a situation where they might have to. Maybe it's medical bills that pile up and cause problems, or it's a situation like yours where a business had a problem or what have you. What's the sign? What are the signs that someone needs to see to say, this is something I need to begin to investigate?
Well, I think probably smart people need the signs earlier. I made the mistake of, you know, I call it the curse of the smart people. You keep thinking this tsunami is coming towards you, but you're going to be able to figure it out. I think most people who pride themselves in having run businesses and been successful think, I'm going to be able to figure this out. I can juggle. I can borrow from Peter to pay Paul, whatever. And I wish that somebody would have given me the wake-up call sooner, because I probably would have been a little more strategic in my approach. It's interesting how you can be objective and run several million-dollar business, but when it comes to your own personal finance, it's a whole different
ball of wax. The cobbler's kids have no shoes.
Absolutely, absolutely. And it's very hard to see, too, when the tsunami is just kind of hitting your face. You're not in a position at that point to stand back and be objective and say, gosh, I wonder how I should handle this today. You're just trying to get air. So I think the key for most people is, if you're feeling financial stress at all, you should be talking to somebody objectively and getting some good, solid feedback about what you should be doing and what your game plan should be.
Who do you talk to?
Well, they could read my book. That would be one thing. Well,
well said.
We interrupt this program to our sponsor, How to Go Broke in Style.
Thank you for that. I think probably you need to be with an accountant, your CPA, somebody objectively who can take a look at your picture and give you some good, solid feedback about it. When I finally got to the point of going to a bankruptcy attorney, they gave me the long spiel about how, you know, it's not our job to tell you what to do. It's just our job to be objective and give you some advice. And after he listened to my current financial situation, he said, oh, boy, you should be filing Chapter 7. I mean, it was that clear at that point, but I didn't know. I hadn't been through the process. So, you know, it's kind of an ugly parallel, but I think it's a little bit like committing suicide. You get to that point where that is your only option. You don't pick that from a variety of options that are available to you. You see that as your only option, and I definitely waited too long.
But you can recover from it.
Absolutely. I'm still here. I'm still driving a nice car and living in a nice house, and I made it. I don't know that I'd say I made it back completely. I'm still trying to figure out what to do with the rest of my life, but I think it's easier to come back if you don't go down the ladder quite as far as I did, if you can recoup and get things back in perspective before you're already at the bottom of the well waiting for somebody to dump something else on you.
But I think so many people fear it because they're so hopeless and think, you know, scarlet letter, as you said.
Right.
I mean, is your credit ruined forever?
You know, it's interesting. I track my credit at least once a month on Quizzle and some of those other, you know, Credit Karma. And I was holding on to a score of 625, like I was clawing to keep that number pre-bankruptcy. And I filed bankruptcy. It went in the toilet very quickly. But now, less than 2 years later, I'm higher than my pre-bankruptcy score. So it still isn't a great score, but it's a better score, and certainly a better score than if I would have just been continuing to try to scrape along.
I asked that question for you to answer just like that. The point is that you may go down, but you're going to come. You can come back
Absolutely.
Up again. And there's workable strategies, and there's hope that you can recover from that.
Absolutely, and I think strategy is one of the key words, which I lacked insight into at the beginning of the process. I was slipping down the hill and didn't grab a tree and stop. But you absolutely can come back. And in some cases, while, you know, bankruptcy is not for everybody, the clean slate of Chapter 7, which is what I filed, is really designed for people to have a fresh start. It's not designed to make you a social outcast and make people not want to talk to you again. It's really designed as a fresh start so that you can really start rebuilding again.
Now, you talk about Chapter 7. There's various forms of this, right?
Yes, Chapter 7 and Chapter 13. 13 is the reorganization, like, you know, you're on the Titanic, but it hasn't been hit yet, so you're rearranging the chairs a little bit, and you're paying back some creditors over a period of time. And I considered that at one point, but my debt, because I still held some business debt, my debt was such that my monthly payment was going to be about $3,000 a month for 5 years. And that's when I finally got the wake-up call and became objective about, wow, I'm going to pay $3,000 for 5 years, or I can just file Chapter 7. And at that point, I thought, ruin my credit, but in 5 years, I could be back better than I was before. So you have to kind of pick and choose, and you need legal advice about where you are and what assets you have and all those kinds of things. But there's really only two choices. Chapter 11 is what you hear about companies filing when they're reorganizing, but Chapter 7 is kind of the granddaddy of them all.
All right, I have to change the subject here a little bit. I'm looking at the table of contents of the book, and the chapter titles are Beatles songs.
I know, and
so
I'm not
what's
even
the story
a Beatles
behind
fan.
You're not even a Beatles fan.
I'm really not. They were a little before my time, but
okay. Now you have to explain that.
I'm one of those kinds of people that it's kind of a weird thing that you're not talking to the star of Medium or anything, but I find myself humming tunes that are very descriptive of the situation that I'm in, without even really realizing it. And as I went through the process, I found that happening, and there seemed to be a theme, and it seemed like they were the perfect fit. They had enough songs out there that they covered everything from My Life is Crap to It's Starting
well,
Over Again.
Let me take a second and read some of these are all Beatles songs. Well, except for one of them. One of them is John Lennon. But I Should Have Known Better, While My Guitar Gently Weeps, We Can Work It Out, Let It Be, Money, That's What I Want, Get a Little Help from My Friends, Long and Winding Road, well, that's probably what it feels like.
Uh-huh.
And Here Comes the Sun. That's kind of the end.
Exactly.
So I like that.
And the sun does come back out again, despite...
See, that's the message I want to get from this episode
yes.
to our audience, is that it's not the end of the world.
Absolutely.
And there is hope. And you got to be smart about it. And you got to get... I think the key is, in addition to reading this fine book, is there is help out there. People that can... They're not evil people.
Absolutely.
They want to be of service. There's probably more helpful people than others, I would guess. But
for sure. I when I first started looking, I went to the bookstore trying to find, you know, without going public, because that was my biggest fear. And so, of like any good American, I watch late night TV, and I saw all those bankruptcy places advertising. So I went to one of those bankruptcy places. I now know they're called mills, as in puppy mills, and found out the hard way that those guys were not the good guys, and they were not the solution for me. Huh. My situation was a little more complex than they could handle. And I guess my first clue should have been I called for an appointment, and they had an appointment for me that next day. Big clue that they either weren't busy enough or they were just churning them out. And I'm walking into the bankruptcy attorney's office, and like Ma and Pa Kettle are walking out of the office bawling, and they had literally just lost the farm. And I thought, oh my God, this is too depressing of a place for me to be in. But in the end, I found a very, very good attorney who cost me probably less, but definitely at least the same amount of money as these guys, and really took the time to understand my case and give me the guidance that I needed along the way.
Yeah, that was my next question, was how do people find the right person? Is there a resource online? I mean, my CPA is a wonderful guy, but I've been with him so long, he's like a friend, I'd almost be embarrassed to go to him.
Right.
I imagine some people have that problem.
Yeah, my tax guy was one of the last ones to know, which is kind of ridiculous. you know, it's just like selling a good book. It's got to be referral-based. And because I was so reluctant to come out of the closet and let people know what was going on, I didn't ask for referrals. I thought I was going to figure it out on my own. And when things finally were bad enough and I started asking for referrals, it took me probably three degrees of separation with attorneys that I knew to get me to the right guy who understood the process and was helpful and really turned out to be the right guy for me.
What are some, I guess, points of relief, I'll call them? What are some things that really remain insulated from the process? I don't know, is it your house, your car? You get to keep your favorite piece of furniture. What doesn't change during this process that gives you a little bit of an anchor to hang on to, if anything? I don't know anything about the process.
Well, it depends on what kind of bankruptcy you're going to file. If you are employed, which I was not, I was self-employed, and as we all know through the housing tsunami that we've gone through, that is like the kiss of death if you have to estimate income and those kinds of things. But it depends on what kind you file and what your income resources are. If you can prove to the courts that you can afford to keep your house or keep your car or keep your boat or whatever it is that you want to keep, you are able to keep some things, but you do have to be able to prove first to your attorney, if he's a good reputable attorney, and to the courts that you have the money to continue to make those payments. And if you don't, then everything is up for grabs. In my case, I was about $200,000 upside down in a house. And not only could I not prove that I was able to keep the house, but didn't want to keep it at that point. It just became so much of a burden to try to crack that nut every month that it just wasn't worth it. So, one of the compelling moments for me was finally deciding to tell my 15-year-old son, about 14 at the time, about what was going on. And he knew. We had the house up for sale. We were looking for a short sale. We were exploring all the avenues that were out there. And he really brought it down to the basics, because after he listened, he said, yeah, I got it, kind of got it. And fortunately, he's enough of an entrepreneur's kid that he welcomed the change and thought that a move would be fun and all that kind of stuff. But his only question to me was, will we have enough money for food? And the answer was, I think so at this point. But, everything is really up for grabs. I think if you're doing it because you really need to and not because you're trying to work the system, then everything truly is up for grabs when you're going through the process. The one thing I will tell you is that nobody wants your fur coat and nobody wants your diamond tennis bracelet. And so if you see me walking around in Atlanta with my fur coat, it's because nobody would buy it from me. You know, you can sell bird cages and all kinds of stuff on Craigslist, but nobody wants anything expensive. So they do not come to your house and clean out your closets and take the stuff that they think is worth value. You have to go and make hopefully an honest statement about what it is that you own and what kind of money you've made from various sources of income. But, you know, Big Brother doesn't come to your house and start going through your closets.
So you're on your way back now. You're obviously invested in doing some other things. Tell us about the kind of work you're doing, what you're out there doing for folks now.
Well, interestingly enough, you were talking about marketing books, and I am a self-published author and found that I needed to be on social media in order to try to get the word out about the book. Purpose of writing the book really was to just help other people, reach out to other people, so hopefully they wouldn't go as far down the ladder as I got before they realized they needed to do something. And so as a result of using social media, I went to a couple different classes and listened to people talk and thought, gosh, I think I know as much or more about this than a lot of people that were
imagine
talking.
That.
So, and, you know, at one point, again, as an entrepreneur, I looked around the room and said, wow, this guy's got 100 bucks. I mean, 100 people in here for 100 bucks a head. I'm missing the boat here. So my new company is called What the Heck is Social Media? And that really is what we do. It's a very tongue-in-cheek approach to social media and just the very, very beginner stuff for people that are still scratching their heads saying, what the heck is social media? I know I need it. I don't know what it means. I don't know how to make money with it. And we teach seminars that are three-hour seminars that can either be in-house or we have them at various locations in the metro area here in Atlanta where we just basically go through what social media is, what are the big four that are really the big basics out there, and how you can use it to monetize your business.
So what's your favorite part about this new business? What do you like the most, and what do you find frustrating, if anything?
Well, I love the business because it's changing so rapidly. I mean, you look at some other venues that, you know, television, what do they say, took 15 years to reach a certain threshold, and Twitter has reached it or Facebook has reached it in 4 years. Everything just moves so quickly that you really have to be paying attention. And as an entrepreneur, I've always embraced and welcomed change. So it's interesting to me to try to stay on top of what's new and what's happening. And it's gratifying to hold a seminar and have somebody go half the way through it and say, I got to go. I mean, I know what kind of stuff I need to do now. And do you have any references for me of people that can do it for me if they don't have time? But the light bulb comes on and they get it and they're ready to roll. So it's pretty exciting.
So can you sell books over Twitter?
Absolutely you can. Absolutely.
Walk us through a little bit of a marketing strategy availing yourself of the Facebook and the MyFace and the Twitter and all that stuff.
The MyFace? I think that it's really critical. One of the things that we teach in our class is that you really have to have a home base. You've got to have an anchor that you're sending people to. So having a Twitter account alone probably isn't as going to be as successful as if you have a link to a website or a blog or whatever. So that's how we've been using Twitter and Facebook. We've been posting interviews on Facebook so that people that aren't in the area can see the interviews and learn about the book, and I've sold lots of books that way. Twitter, we ask questions and make it conversational about the process of bankruptcy and how people that are going through the process are dealing with it and trying to make it a conversation instead of just a one-way push marketing. And then we drive them to our blog where we tell the stories of, we call it the journey on the road from riches to rags, and kind of tell the story of what it means to go through different processes and highlight, you know, different scenarios that have happened to us.
So how can our listeners get in touch with you, learn more about your social media work, and or get their hands on this book?
Well, our blog is thebankruptexecutive.com, and we are on Twitter also as The Bankrupt Exec. And our social media classes, I try to make life really, really simple. So it is, what the heck is social media?
That's Don't you love that?
So scratch your head and say, what the heck is social media, and you'll find us on the web.
All right, so you heard us put our first guest on the hot seat. Of course, our whole conversation may be the answer to this question, but
she wrote a whole book on recovering from a mistake.
Yes, I don't know, but we'll ask you the question. So, what's the biggest mistake you made in your career, and what did you learn from it?
I have owned a couple of different businesses now, and the biggest mistake has been not having an exit strategy going in. I have operated businesses that I loved and I was passionate about, and I used to get calls in one business that I owned. I'd get calls at least once a week with people trying to buy the business, and I remember thinking very clearly, why the heck would I want to sell this business? It's going well. I love what I'm doing. That's when you sell. And when the light bulb came on and I was a little past getting the calls once a week, the offers weren't quite as good as they had been before, and I had to make some exceptions, like holding a note, which, you know, obviously that's lesson number two. Don't ever hold a note unless it's your, well, forget it. Even if it's your mother, don't ever hold
a note.
Especially
if it's your mother.
Yeah. So, you know, I just think you, you got to be smart, and you got to know that when things are going the best you think they ever have, that's the time to start thinking about selling.
That's I hear that advice all the time. That's great stuff. Thank you. Well, let me just tell you how much I appreciate sharing what was a very personal story.
Thanks.
And putting it into writing for all the world to see. That's how you people really learn. And so I know that I'm grateful. I'm sure our audience is very
grateful. Well, that really is so gracious of you to make yourself vulnerable and share that with the world. And incredibly valuable, I think, to a lot of folks.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Well, I've been called the new face of bankruptcy, and I think people have to realize that it's not just for people that are living in the double wides out there. It can happen to anybody.
Yeah, that is, that's the two messages I want to, it can happen to anybody, but you can recover from it.
Absolutely.
Well, Todd, that was a fun show, buddy.
It sure was.
Well, until next time, this is Stone Payton, Todd Schnick, our guest Dave Sutton, and Linda Frakes. Our producer, Lee Cantor, and everyone here at the Radio X family saying we'll see you in the fast lane.